I always say, if you're bothered by the fact that somebody else is getting the laugh and you're not getting it, then it's not the job for you. You should go and try and be a stand-up comedian or a TV presenter yourself. And that's just never been something I wanted to do.
Hello and welcome to In Writing. I'm Hattie Crissell and my guest today is Christine Rose, who I'm going to go ahead and say that she might be the most prolific British comedy writer who you've never heard of. Christine is hard to categorise because she's done a lot of work in various different fields, but here are some of the biggies. She writes scripts for presenters of award ceremonies, including on several occasions Graham Norton as presenter of the BAFTAs. She's also written for people like Jack Whitehall, Sue Perkins, Richard Osman, Claudia Winkleman, and even Samuel L. Jackson, as we'll discuss in this episode, for events including the GQ Men of the Year Awards, the MTV Europe Awards, the Brits, the TV Choice Awards, and lots more. Basically, if you see someone up on a stage wearing black tie and telling jokes, there's a very good chance that Christine wrote them. She's also spent many years writing for entertainment shows, including 8 out of 10 Cats, Have I Got News for You, The Ranganation, and Would I Lie to You? The comedians she's written for include Rob Brydon, Jimmy Carr, Frankie Boyle, and Jason Manford. She's also written monologues for chat shows like The Graham Norton Show, The Jonathan Ross Show, and Alan Carr Chatty Man. And last year, she won Best TV Comedy Writer at the Funny Women Awards. I've known Christine for about 13 years, and for this interview I went over to her home in North London on a very warm day in September, and we sat in her new extension at the back of her flat. The door onto the garden was open, so you will hear some birds and barking dogs during this interview, but I hope that just adds exciting urban wildlife atmosphere. Christine told me about how the scripts for a show like Have I Got News for You come together, the many moving parts of a good BAFTA monologue, and why she's happy to be the woman who writes the jokes rather than the one performing them. So, over to Christine.
I basically built a whole new room, which sounds extravagant, but I did. My flat is very small. So I built another room because I wanted somewhere else to work. So I had the desk against the wall, but I can look out of the doors into the garden, and it's quite nice to see, you know, plants, squirrels.
It's lovely.
It sort of helps a bit, but also my boyfriend's working at home as well, so we need two separate spaces to work. Otherwise, I'm trying to do something, and then he's on a Zoom conference call talking about business things that... and we just get in each other's brains, and you need to be able to have some space where you can, you know, work separately.
Yeah, and also maybe like just be separate for a few hours.
Yeah.
So talk me through, like, what are these, is figurine the right word on the desk?
Oh, they're not mine. my boyfriend Marco collects, I'm going to call them robots. I do call them robots. They are sort of Japanese robot-y things.
So they're not essential to the writing process or anything?
No, I mean, they're fine. But I don't get the same inspiration from them that he does.
So is there anything in it? Because it's still, it's quite minimalist in here at the moment. Is that because it's a new room, or is this just what you're like? Just tidy.
I tidied up for you coming. I do like it to be a bit minimalist, but in the same respect, I can also work surrounded by stuff. I think over the years I've just trained myself that I need to write, so I just need to do it, and I'm quite good at blocking other stuff out. But seeing as it's my choice here, I choose to try and keep it as tidy as I can, so it's not stuff that's clogging up your brain when you're trying to think about other things.
So do you do, in your sort of line of work, are you spending, when you're writing, are you mostly on your own, or are you mostly in a room with other writers?
Years ago, I was probably in writers' rooms more. But over time, there's less and less collaborative rooms, which is a shame.
Why is that?
I think it's money. You know, to fill a room with writers is expensive, particularly experienced ones. It depends if they want quality or quantity. Sometimes if they want quality, they'll still have a room. Like, I've Got News For You still has a writer's room, and I can't see a day when you'll be writing separately from home, because they're not looking for quantity, they're looking for quality.
And you get better jokes and when you have people bouncing off each other.
Yes,
is that the idea?
Absolutely, yeah. So one person might have an idea, and it might be a fully formed joke, and it might be absolutely fine, it can be written down as it is and great. Or other people might chip in and make it better, and you bounce it around for a while, you discuss words and phrases and, you know, different punchlines, and then you get one that you decide on, and it's a collaborative process, and you end up with less jokes than if you were all feverishly writing separately at home, but much higher quality, you know, to a point. But yeah, it's more expensive for a show to do that. So they might want to have two writers on the show, and they think, okay, well, we'll get more material if they write separately from home, and it's, you know, maybe cheaper, maybe we can have more days.
Do you feel funnier when you're in a room with other comedy writers than you do sitting on your own? Or like, how easy is it to conjure up the funny on your own?
Sometimes it's nice to just sit on your own and just think, and think, what is the best word to use here? What's the best phrase? What's the best angle? And, you know, and you can really write it in your own way without anyone else saying, oh, I think it's better like this. Because you might agree or you might not agree, but there is, it's brilliant being in a room with other people, particularly other people that you respect and are good writers. You can bounce stuff around and you can have a laugh, and yeah, and you can get reaction to what you said. So you know that something's good if everyone's laughing. Whereas on your own, you can be like, this is brilliant, well done me. And then it turns out that other people didn't agree, and you know.
Yeah, it must feel so good to be in a writer's room and make your joke and have people burst out laughing. Like, there must be such a high.
Yeah, and it's like the old Nevermind the Buzzcocks rooms were always really good for that. There was lots of, you know, back and forth, and you know, they weren't brutal, not in my day. I think the earlier ones were that I wasn't in. But there was a lot more piss-taking and, you know, and of course I was the only woman. And
really?
Yeah. So, I mean, on Have I Got News For You now, they have been having two women in the writer's room.
How many men would be in there?
Well, they have small writer's rooms, so there's normally three people in a room.
Okay. So sometimes it's two women and a man?
Sometimes, yeah.
Wow.
I took a picture. The first time it happened when I was in there with Katie Story, I took a picture because I'd never experienced that on the show before.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good sign, I suppose. Things are...
Oh, yeah. You know, they are employing more women, and they are changing. You know, yeah. It takes a bit of time. I think people want everything to change overnight, and suddenly everybody changes and everyone's attitudes change, and, you know, and it does take some time.
Yeah.
Also, it takes time for new writers to get good enough to be in there.
Yeah.
So, you know, everything takes a bit of time.
Yeah. Are you writing something at the moment?
Yeah, I've been doing just various... There's a lot of variety, which I like. I think in America, you tend to get staffed on a show, one show, and that's what you do for... however long you're staffed for, and then move on to another one. But I quite like, you know, there are benefits to that. Obviously, you've got a regular wage, and, you know, particularly in America where you need the insurance and all of those things, that's works well for their system. But I do like it here in the sense that you can work on lots of different shows. You know, so in one week I can do five different shows.
Yeah.
So
does that keep it feeling a bit sort of fresher?
Yeah, I think so, because you'll do, you know... you'll do a panel show, you'll do a game show, you know, you might do an awards show, and it's, some are topical, some are not topical, different people, different comedians. So it really keeps it fresh, I think, and keeps it different. And it means you can do a job for longer and not get bored.
When do you remember first being interested in writing?
I've always struggled to write straight copy. You know, I remember when I started at secondary school, and we had to write one of those like quizzes, but sort of, you know, where you often get them in women's magazines. I can't remember what they're called.
But a personality quiz.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So then at the end, then you can say, oh, you're an A or a B or a C type thing. And everyone else wrote quite straight ones. And mine made the teacher laugh. And I remember him reading it out.
That's so good.
And it just was my instinct to write it like that rather than make it serious. And I just enjoy it more. It's more fun for me.
Yeah.
That's why I don't think I could ever write a sort of serious novel or anything. I just don't, my brain doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've always sort of liked writing stupid things, silly things.
Do you remember at some point sort of realising that that was a job and that you might be able to do that for a living?
I mean, I tried to be a bit of a journalist for a while and I was terrible at that because you do have to, you know, write some serious things. You can't just make everything stupid and ridiculous and take the piss out of everything, you know. So I wasn't particularly good at that. I had a couple of articles in those like free magazines that you used to have on the tube. There was Gat, Girl About Town.
Oh, wow.
I had a couple of little column-y bits in there. They basically had a column at the start and you could send stuff in and they would, you know, give you, I think I got 70 quid for it or something.
So at what point did you start move more towards comedy writing rather than journalism?
Well, I always wanted to work in TV, but I didn't have any contacts with anyone that works in television. So I didn't have any sort of way in. So I thought, well, what do you do? And I've been doing sociology at university, and a lot of that was kind of, you know, sending out questionnaires and stuff, gathering data and things. And they, and so I thought, well, I just have to send out enough, you know, letters, and I just ask people, you never know. And so they had the White Book, which was like a book that was a list of all the production companies. And so I just wrote to loads of them, basically saying, can I be a runner? I just finished university. I did sociology and media studies. So I'm not qualified for anything. So could I be a runner? And I remember in sociology them saying there's like a 10%, you know, if you said there's normally a 10% response rate for you know,
if you send out randomly.
If you send out, you know, questionnaires or whatever. And it pretty much was exactly, I think I sent out 100 letters and I got 10 replies.
It's amazing that you sent out 100 letters. Like, good for you.
Yeah. Well, I just thought, I'm just going to shit bomb them. I got 10 responses.
Not shit bomb, love bomb.
Love bomb. Please give me. I got 10 responses and those 10 responses were all, oh, thanks, but no.
Oh.
So, yeah, it didn't get me anywhere.
Oh, no.
Apart from, you know, thinking, oh, that is right. You do get a 10% response rate of no's. And so I was like, oh, okay. And then I was like, what do I do now? And then my flatmate's friend had just got a job at a design company and they were looking for a receptionist. And he was like, well, just go in and have a chat, see what happens. And I was like, oh, so what design? And it turned out to be sort of opening, closing, titling, that sort of thing. Sort of digital design.
On TV.
And, yeah. Some of it was adverts, some of it was, you know, sort of, they did the Channel 4 ident in the early 2000s that span around. Remember the 4 used to spin around? It would like, dun, dun,
dun, dun. Yeah.
And it span across the, they did those. And so I was like, this is sort of like telly.
Yeah.
It's a bit like telly. And I just sort of made them laugh a bit in the interview and they were like, yeah, okay. They basically just wanted somebody to be a runner, essentially. I answered the phones and I made tea and I ran tapes in and out of Soho. I looked after people's kids in the holidays. I was literally like, oh, you know.
Were you doing your journalism stuff at the same, you know, writing for GAT? That was
really early when I got that job.
Right.
And it didn't pay very much. So I was still working in a bar in the evenings. So I was a bit mad. I was like a full day at work and then I'd go and work in a bar till like 11 o'clock at night.
Oh God. And then get a little bit of sleep and then start again.
Yeah. And eventually they sort of fired me from the bar job because I think I just burst into tears one night or something and they were just like, are you all right? And I was like, I'm very tired. They were like, I think maybe your time here is done. Oh. And maybe you should concentrate on your day job. And I was like, okay, thank you. So yeah, I left doing the bar job and just sort of worked there. And then it changed into, they still were doing the design stuff, but then they started to move more into interactive TV and like gaming. So yeah, and it became a company called Play Jam, which your older listeners might remember. It was on Sky and NTL and Telewest, and it was a games channel, and it was games that you play through your remote, through your set-top box with your remote control.
Okay.
And we didn't have the funding of Sky, who could buy in big names, Disney and Shrek and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we just had to make up characters and make up concepts for games that were funny and would make people go, oh, that looks funny, because they were paying to play them.
Right. This is amazing. I never knew that you'd done this.
Yeah, it was really good fun because we were young. The office was in, you know, Shoreditch. When Shoreditch, you know, early 2000s, it was proper Nathan Barley, people skateboarding through the office, you know, people turning up to work with massive hangovers, wearing salopettes and like, you know, just sort of Shoreditch nonsense, Old Street nonsense, you know, before all the bankers had moved in. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And you know, to me, it was sort of still TV. I was getting to write. I became the editor of the channel, which sounds really huge, but it was a very small channel.
Still.
And, yeah, and I would sort of work with the artists and designers because we would make all of the games. So there would be programmers and there would be artists that would draw, you know, illustrators that would draw the game art. And, yeah, and I would help do copy for the games. There was loading screens that needed copy on, funny things, help to come up with names for stuff. Mm-hmm. And just sort of make it funny and entertaining. And
so at what point did you make the move into writing for non-gaming TV?
Well, the company made good money for a while, and then after the internet kicked off quite well, and people were like, oh, I'm not sure that we need to be paying for games through our set-top box anymore. Yeah, and then it just started changing. It started becoming weirder and more corporate and less fun, and, you know, no one was allowed to skateboard anymore, and people had to, yeah, it just became more of a business, more, and the fun had gone out of it, and it wasn't making the money that it used to. And then somebody I worked with knew somebody in TV, and they just happened to be out for a drink one night, and they said they were making a new panel show and they were looking for writers. And she just happened to say something like, I quite like to find a female writer, but we haven't been able to find any that have, you know, been any good for us. Or, and he just said, oh, a girl I work with would be really good at that. And then he hooked us up and they sent me some stuff from the show.
What was the show?
That was the second series of 8 out of 10 Cats.
Wow.
They'd only made one series, but they were writing a lot of stuff for the guests, you know, because the panel shows are long records. A lot of the comedians are quite new. So they would write gag packs to give them sort of help. So, if, you know, some ideas in there, some other jokes, which they don't do now. But yeah, it was sort of prepping for the show, really, in case somebody was really stuck and needed some help. Or so, yeah, I was writing for those. So I just did a load of stuff for nothing, just to sort of writing samples, really. And I didn't really think any more of it. And then they contacted me and said, oh, we really like this. Can you do some more? And I was like, yes. And I spent quite a lot of time on it. I really thought about it, and I would try and make it really good. And I thought, I'm not going to pay for this anyway, and I've been made redundant, and I'm just at home doing nothing, so I might as well, you know, try and really think about this.
When you were sending in samples and stuff, was it one-liners? Or kind of, you know, self-contained jokes, or is that not really how it works?
They would tell me what they needed. So they would say, okay, so some of it was missing words, so it would be like, oh, 80% of cats like to do what in the morning? And it would be a true statistic. And then you would have to come up with some funny words that might go in there. So it was literally just a list of words that could go in there that would be funny. And then there was other sections that were sort of short jokes. And then eventually I think they said that they would pay me. They said, "Will you do a day a week?" I think they said. And then I think they paid me a small amount of money. So I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I can't believe I just got paid for that.
That's amazing. That must have felt so exciting.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, is this a job? Does this happen? Because we don't really talk about it. It's just like a weird secret we have in this country that there are writers for TV. It's not celebrated in the way it is in America. You know, in America, it's like, these are my writers. I couldn't do it without them. And then they have these like award shows and all the writers are like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I won best writer. and you know, it's all out in the open. Everyone's really happy about it. And they're celebrated. And here it's like, get in that room and stay in there and don't tell anyone.
Yeah.
You're like, okay. So no one really, I mean, it's people talk about it more now, but I don't remember anyone talking much about, unless it was old sitcom writers or, you know, the two Ronnies having people writing sketches for them and stuff. But I don't remember it being something I knew about panel shows and chat shows. And
no, I don't think I knew until I met you and that was what you did. I think most people watching a show like 8 out of 10 Cats would assume that the people who they are watching came up with all of the jokes that they're making.
Well, they probably are more so now. Well, actually, I don't know, because they'll probably... We don't have the same gag pack, is what I'm saying. But a lot of the comedians on will employ a writer to help them, whether it's somebody they know or a stand-up. Right. Or there'll be people on the day that will go and see them and help them with stuff if they want stuff. Some people don't. Some people do it all on their own. You know, it depends on the individual comedian. It depends on what they need. Sometimes they just want to run stuff by people and go, what do you think about this? Or... Particularly with 8 out of 10 Cats, they often have new comedians. So the team captains will be established, but they'll have writers. But the newer comedians, you know, sometimes do need a bit of help.
Yeah. Do you still do 8 out of 10 Cats?
Well, yes. I keep thinking it's died, but, you know, it really does have, you know, 9 lives. Yeah, so I'm hoping they'll do some more. But it hasn't been officially killed.
Yeah.
But I still do 8 out of 10 Cats to Countdown.
So would you talk me through that? If you're working on 8 out of 10 Cats or Have I Got News For You or a comedy panel show, what is the sort of writing process?
First of all, you've got to get your days on it. So they'll allocate you a certain amount of days. And it depends, you know, on Have I Got News For You, I'll do less than I would on 8 out of 10 Cats. I'm doing it longer. I've written for Jimmy for a long time. On Have I Got News For You, there are a lot more writers and they have to have days. So you'll get allocated your days and you normally have a day, you know, maybe you might get 5 days or 6 days or, you know. Now it's on Zoom. So it's still a writer's room, but it's a Zoom writer's room. Yeah, you'll get together at like 10. There's maybe 3 writers normally. Sometimes 2 on a Tuesday, 3 on a Wednesday. I think they have 3 now on show day on the Thursday. Tuesday is normally the sillier rounds. Wednesday's the heavy news, topical news days. And then Thursday is the filling in the gaps. So, because that's the show day. So once the host comes in and sees everything, they might say, well, I don't like that, or I'm not going to say that, or have we got anything better there? Stuff will get cut and there'll be gaps. So you're filling in the gap, or new stories as well. So it's new stories, gaps, whatever they need really. And then you have a list of things that you need to do and you just work through it in the room.
So what is it fun doing writing for comedy panel shows?
It is fun. I do think sometimes people think it's just pissing about though and there's no work. And actually some rooms can be quite hard. You do have a lot of stuff to do. Things like Have I Got News For You are fun, but sometimes they are hard work as well.
Yeah.
Particularly topics that you've done a million times. I remember someone saying that to me when I first started, another writer, and they said, you know, people think the hardest thing is being funny about something or being able to write a joke on something. And he said, it's not that. The hardest thing is having to write a joke about something that you've written jokes about a million times.
Yeah. And they just keep coming up in the news and you keep having to come up with a new way to take the piss out of them or a new bit of satire.
And a lot of that, and he was completely right, a lot of the job is that. You know, whether it's years of writing about Brexit or whether it's, whether it was Trump or, you know, at least Trump was constantly doing new things, you know, or Christmas. It's something that happens all the time and it keeps coming up and you're like, Christmas show, we need some Christmas jokes. And you're like, no more Christmas. Or, you know, anything like that. Wimbledon, you know, something that's like a regular thing that if you're doing a panel show and it's topical, it's going to pop up and you've got to think of new angles all the time.
Yeah.
So that's the hardest thing, I think.
And presumably there are lots of jokes that go down well in the writer's room, and then when the host says it on the night, the audience doesn't laugh and it goes in the bin. Is that something that, you know, in the edit?
So much goes in the bin. Yeah. I mean, so much goes in the bin before any of that, before it even gets to an audience, you know. Years ago, that used to bother me sometimes. I would think, oh, that's a really good joke, and I could see it in the virtual bin, and I'd be like, and it would annoy me, and I'd be like, that's a really good joke. Why is it in the bin? But now you're just like, it's fine, we'll just write more.
Yeah. So you also write scripts for awards shows, for awards show hosts.
Yeah.
So when that sort of gig comes in, what kind of constraints or guidance are you generally given about what they want from that, and how do you approach the writing of something like that?
I suppose you're given the same constraints that you're given on any show, really. You know, you're constrained by the time it's on, you're constrained by who the host is, what they're going to want to say. You're constrained by the channel, you know, the production company. So yeah, there are lots of, but it depends on the awards show. Like, I've done a lot of kind of sort of magazine-y ones like Glamour and GQ and those sorts of things. And they have different constraints to your sort of televised ones. They are more scared of jokes. They want it to be much more celebratory. Yeah, and yeah, they're looking after the fact that, you know, I did get in trouble doing Glamour one year when I wrote some jokes about Kim Kardashian, which I thought were fine. I thought these are quite mild, but forgetting that they want to have Kim Kardashian maybe
interviewed
in their magazine or do a cover. Yeah. So they can't be doing my little quips about her at the awards show, which for me is a bit frustrating and a bit like, oh, come on. It's particularly when they have a comedian doing it. I'm like, well, don't get a comedian, get a supermodel. Or
yeah.
Then it's like, you know, why are you getting a comedian?
Yeah.
Because some people think they want things to be funny, and then actually, once you start to sort of put some funny in there, they get scared, and they get very scared of who's going to be offended. And, you know, even if maybe my moral compass is a bit skewed of what I think is fine. But yeah, those are much more difficult to navigate. And particularly for some, I've written for a real random selection of people. I did Stanley Tucci, Samuel L. Jackson, Michael Sheen, Mark Strong. The only one I met out of all of those was Michael Sheen. Mm. I didn't get to meet any of the others. I have no idea what their sense of humour is. I have no idea. So they were hard because you're writing blind. The magazine doesn't give you a lot in terms of help because they're like, well, this is where it's being held. This is who the host is. You know, it's the 18th one, you know. So they give you some information.
Do you know who's on the guest list?
Not often. You know who's presenting some of the awards because you have to write intros to them. So you know they're going to be there. But they tend to not be necessarily people that you would want to do jokes about or anything. You know, they're kind of just sort of nice, you know, a supermodel and a, you know, an entrepreneur, and it's like, great, but there are bigger names in the room. But then that creates its own problems because they want you to reference the people in the room because they want it to be like, oh my god, it's Elton John, it's Victoria Beckham. And over time you learn, oh, they definitely don't want the joke that I'm think I want to write about Victoria Beckham. They definitely don't want that. And so you're like, so you learn early on, no, don't do that. So then you're like, okay, I've got this. I'm going to write a nice joke referencing Victoria Beckham, but it's going to be about something else. So I'll do the swerve.
Right. So it might be a joke about the fashion industry or something.
Exactly. Or you know, a joke about someone else in the room. You know,
or the Spice Girls.
Yeah. But could we go Victoria Beckham, end it on Piers Morgan? Could we go Victoria Beckham, end it on something topical in the news?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's fine, I'll just do the swerve. And then they get scared and they don't even want the swerve. So they're like, no, we can't do any joke around her. And right. I was like, but then they're just saying, Victoria Beckham's here. And that's just mental. You can't say that.
Yeah, that's weird.
So you're in this thing of like, if I can't make a joke at her, about her, which I understand why I can't, if I can't do the swerve, am I just complimenting a woman?
Yeah.
Via, you know.
And how do you make that funny?
Yeah, and if it's not funny, why am I doing it? Or are we just giving her a round of applause because she's here?
Yeah.
Because we can do that, but is that not weird?
Yeah.
Those became very difficult for me. And also, sometimes they wouldn't tell you who was there. And then the editor would ring you really angry that you haven't mentioned so-and-so. And you're like, I didn't know they were there.
Yeah.
You didn't tell me they were there. Also, they get very stressed near the awards because, you know, they want it to be amazing and they're under a lot of pressure. And sometimes they take that on you and you're like, well, I didn't know they were going to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's some that I've written that they were so happy with. They said, this is going to be the, like, blueprint going forward. They were like, this is amazing. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so brilliant. And then the next year I write it exactly the same tone. You know, I've got the tone. I'm not going to start going crazy. And they hated it. And I had to rewrite it like 3 times. And I was like, I'm not amazing anymore. I'm rubbish.
Oh, no.
And it's like, I just don't understand what the difference was because I hadn't just suddenly made... But sometimes you make references that they just don't like and you don't know what references they like. So yeah, you just have to kind of judge it. The Samuel L. Jackson one was really weird because I said, could it be sent to maybe his people and he can read it? And then, you know... Because
sure
I might
happy.
Be way off the mark here. And then if he hates it, I can, you know, he can give me some pointers and maybe I can... And they're like, no. Couldn't have any communication. I mean, I wasn't expecting to be able to call up Samuel L. Jackson. Obviously.
Maybe pop round, open a bottle of wine and see what comes.
Yeah, but it's like, surely he's going to read this before...
Yeah.
And anyway, I wrote some stuff and, you know, he'd read the monologue and, you know, he did a lot of the monologue. And I was there for it and I was like, this is amazing. I'm loving this. And then he didn't seem to have read the intros into the people. You know, so if someone's coming up to present an award to somebody, you'll have to write an introduction to them. You know, I call it the blardy blahs. You're like, next up, he's blardy. And he's certainly blardy. He's blardy. And then they come on and then they do their little speech and then they present an award. And so you have to write all of these. And sometimes there's loads. Sometimes there's like 20, 25 of them. And sometimes they're, you know, quite obscure supermodels or, you know, just or low-level actors that have been in, that are up and coming, but they're in things you've never seen and nobody really knows them yet. So there's nothing to sort of hang your hat on. So you're like, oh, those are really hard. And he was reading... the intros off the auto cue, and I don't think anyone had bothered to show him those.
I know.
Because there was one into Elton John, and I cannot remember what it was. I remember finding it quite funny at the time. And he read it, and then he just went, I'm sorry, I don't know who wrote this.
Oh, no.
It's a room full of people. I was like, oh, this is going so well.
So close.
Yeah. But, you know, that's what happens if somebody doesn't read something. If it's the first time it's in front of their eyes, it's when they're in a room full of people. It's horrible.
Yeah. In general, in your job, not just with the award ceremonies, but whoever you're writing for, them, familiarising yourself with the voice of the person who's going to read it must be quite a big part of the gig, I imagine, especially if you're writing for comedians, I suppose, because you know what sounds like a Graham Norton joke and what doesn't sound like a Graham Norton joke.
Actually, Graham can be quite hard sometimes, actually. Sometimes I think I've sort of nailed down Graham's sense of humour a bit, and then he won't go for the jokes that I think he will. I mean, he really knows what he wants to say, so he's very sure about whether he likes a joke or he doesn't like a joke. But yeah, when I did his chat show, I did watch a lot of his monologues to try and get into, you know, into the tone and into the sort of topics and the things that the references that he likes to use. comedians are definitely easier.
Who's your favourite person to write for?
Oh, that's hard because I have sort of favourites for different reasons. I love writing for Jimmy because I've done it for the longest and he just loves, you know, short, punchy jokes. So, and that's sort of, because I started writing for him, that's sort of how I was trained to write jokes. But then I like writing for, I used to like writing for Alan Carr and Chatty Man. I love Alan's world. I love writing for Graham as well. Like all the BAFTAs I did for Graham were some of my proudest stuff was writing for Graham on the BAFTAs, I think.
Yeah.
The TV, and then we did the film BAFTAs in 2019. You know, and going back to what you were saying about, you know, the restraints of writing for awards shows, BAFTAs is a funny one in that respect because you've got the host, you've got BAFTA, you've got the BBC, and they all have, you know, their own opinions. So you'll write a load of jokes. Graham will pick or whoever the host is will pick the ones that they like. They'll add their own stuff. You know, you'll end up with a script that they're relatively happy with, but they're going to have more additions at some point. But then when you have the big meeting, that's when things start to unravel because the BBC have their own set of rules. They have their own things they need to protect, you know, which is, you know, fine. I completely understand that. The BBC have to look after and make sure that they're catering for, you know, their license fee supported. So, you know, there's a lot of things that the BBC worry about. And then BAFTA might be okay with something the BBC aren't, or BBC might be okay with something BAFTA aren't. So there's often jokes that fall through the middle, really good jokes that the hosts might love. And sometimes the host will fight for them, but often they'll get to the point where they're like, it's just not worth arguing about this anymore. And I was thinking about this earlier because I had an example of this when we were doing the film BAFTAs. You get a list of all the nominated films and the monologue needs to incorporate the lots of these nominated films, particularly the most nominated films. So it's almost like a puzzle trying to fit topical events, the films together in some way to create a joke that fits, you know, so it's quite a juggling act. And once you've sort of got one that you think really works, it's very difficult to pull that apart because
then you're like, well, where am I going to mention this movie if not in that joke?
Yeah, this fits perfectly with this topical event. There's no point saying, can we have another movie in there? You're like, well, there isn't another one that works with that event. So it becomes, so there was this joke that I remember we had and it caused a lot of problems. I'm going to tell you what it was. It was the biggest film nominations tonight really do sum up Britain over the last year. There's 1917, Marriage Story and Joker. A fight with Europe, a messy divorce, all led by a psychopathic clown. Now, everyone liked this joke. It incorporated the most nominated films. It incorporated topical events, the biggest topical events of the year. Graham liked it. It was all good. And till it starts getting picked apart and then we're into, you know, it becomes a political argument then, and then it's like, okay, the BBC aren't happy with it because they don't want to call Boris a psychopathic clown. And you know, the BBC get a lot of shit for taking, you know, and they have to be neutral. And you know, our argument was this: way worse things have been said about Boris on loads of BBC shows. You know, we've said worse things than that on Graham's chat show in the monologue. You know, I've definitely said worse things than that on stuff that we've written for Have I Got News For You. But their argument was it was in the context of this awards show and those are different shows. They're comedy shows.
Yeah.
And
people don't tune in necessarily to the BAFTAs in order to see that sort of, or expecting that sort of political content.
Yeah, and so someone will say, can we change it? I said, what's your main issue? Is it the word psychopathic or is it the word clown? And they were like, clown's okay, maybe, but not psychopathic. And so someone's like, can we call him an idiotic clown? A silly clown? And there's this back and forth of like, you know, what other words. And what people often don't think about is the fact that they're thinking, what other things can we call Boris? And as I kept pointing out, this has to work also as a way of describing the Joker.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think the Joker's a silly little clown.
Yeah.
I wouldn't describe Joaquin Phoenix's Joker as
an idiotic
clown. And so it becomes things like that, really, where you're desperately trying to save a joke that you think this is taken a while to construct and it has many moving parts. And if you take out some of these parts, the joke just explodes, and you just can't tinker with something. Sometimes you can, and you can just sort of tinker it away and you're like, fixed. But we just couldn't fix it.
Yeah.
And it just went in the bin. And we were like, bye. Bye-bye.
Oh, and there'll never be another opportunity to use that.
Exactly. Well, that's when it does become a shame, because you're like, when are we going to use that?
Yeah.
You know, no one else is going to... Anyone need a list of nominated BAFTA films
with a
topical twist? Anyone?
You were saying before about how, you know, you didn't know until you were asked to do 8 out of 10 cats that there were writers doing that kind of work. And I was thinking that you're well known and you're respected within your industry, and you won an award last year. But the average person sitting at home watching Graham do a BAFTAs speech or whatever it is doesn't know that you're the woman behind it. Is it ever frustrating to you that you're never the face of the joke? You're sort of behind the scenes doing the hard work. Well, some of the hard work.
No, I think I always say, if you're bothered by the fact that somebody else is getting the laugh and you're not getting it, then it's not the job for you.
Yeah.
You should go and try and be a stand-up comedian or a TV presenter yourself. And that's just never been something I wanted to do. I've been with people who have been starting out on the circuit and at those open mic nights, and, you know, they often have to take somebody with them when they start out to fill up the audience. So it's not just comedians doing, you know, new comedians doing jokes to other comedians that aren't listening. So I used to go with my friend quite a lot and be his sort of plus one in the audience. And it was just, oh God, it used to make me feel sick. Sometimes I would have to leave the room, not with my friend, he was actually very good. But sometimes I would have to leave the room because some of them were so, and they were fine with it. You know, they weren't terrible. You know, everyone has to start, you know, every time you start at something, you're not going to be amazing at it. It takes time. But I just thought, oh God, I don't know how they can do that. It just makes me feel, I'm just not that sort of person.
Yeah.
And the pressure on, particularly when you're doing something like the BAFTAs, the pressure to walk, you know, the experience that a lot of these TV presenters have, and they still get, you know, they're still like... Because things like the BAFTAs, the newspapers are really focusing on what you're saying, the jokes. You know, lots of panel shows and chat shows and stuff, people don't print your monologues and individual jokes, unless you've crossed some line somewhere and stuff's got wrong. People don't, you know, they're just jokes on a show. But with the BAFTAs, you know, they get printed in the paper.
Mm.
You know, one of my friends was saying that years ago he did the TV BAFTAs with Jonathan Ross, and the jokes were printed in the paper with like a laughometer.
Oh no, oh God.
And he was just like, ah.
Do you stay off Twitter when there's, you know, something like that on? Because I was watching, I won't name it, but I was watching a live show last night, and I went on Twitter, and Twitter was just full of, it was like one of the trending topics, and Twitter was just full of people saying what a bad job the hosts were doing. And I was like, oh, that's got to really hurt for that person who comes home and discovers that this has been the feedback from the country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got offended on behalf of writers one year. I didn't even do it. It was a film BAFTAs, and I think it was Joanna Lumley. And people were being so shitty about the monologue, and it was all, you know, they love a bit of sack the writers. And it was like, these people just don't understand anything about the process of what happens and how these jokes, you know, get into this script. And it's like, writers can write writers will write whatever you want. If you want a really edgy, rude monologue, they'll give you one. If you want a mild monologue that's all, oh, I'm so happy to be here, they'll give you that. They're writing what they're asked to write, and they're writing for the host. And, you know, people are watching Joanna Lumley do some jokes, and it's like, well, what do you want from this? She's not Ricky Gervais. She's not going to be doing that. This isn't a roast.
Yeah.
You know, she's decided that these jokes are what she's happy with. And they, you know, so there will be a massive pile of other jokes that never made it. Writers don't get to decide what makes the edit on that. The channel decides, the BBC decides, BAFTA decides, the host decides. If they ask you your opinion, you can give it. But you're not putting together the final script, just jokes that you like.
Can you think of anything concrete that you have learned over the years that really improved your writing?
That's a hard question. Well, keep up to date on the news for sure. If you're writing for lots of different people, you know, watch their comedy. Whoever you're writing for, you want to write for, watch what they do. You know, because if you're writing for them, you have to write in their style. You know, you have to pay attention to lots of details. Lots of new writers. I did it, so I know that they do it because I did it. You know, don't pay attention to what time is the show on. Who is the host? What time's it on? What channel's it on? All of these things inform the tone of what you're doing. I've had people send me jokes before and they're just, you know, very edgy Frankie Boyle style jokes. And it's like, okay, but what's this for?
Yeah.
Is this for a chat show? Where do you see these jokes being?
Yeah, don't write a 10 p.m. Channel 4 joke for an 8 p.m. BBC One show.
And I've seen people do that before, and it's like they're so obsessed with the fact that they think they've written this brilliant joke, and it's like it's only brilliant in the context of where it's being used. Out of that context, it can be awful.
Yeah.
You know, and it can show that you're not paying attention to the things that you need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
So yeah, that really helped me in terms of tone for different people.
Yeah.
You know, are they an observational comedian that's, you know, I wouldn't write the same stuff for Jason Manford that I would write for Jimmy, because they're very different tonally and they have a different style. You know, Jason's more observational and he has a longer, you know, he likes a longer form, whereas Jimmy likes a very short joke. And, you know, tonally they're very different. But, you know, once you understand that and once you think that you can change how you write, then it opens so many opportunities up in writing for other people. So you know, some people just write for the same person forever and, you know, and have a lovely time and that's great. But when you're freelance, you really need to be able to maximise the avenues and the people that you write for. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot of downtime waiting for that person to, you know, their show to start again, or you know, maybe that show will get cancelled and that person will decide they're going to retire and they don't want to, or they're just going to go off and do their own stand-up for a while. So you always have to have lots of other things and other, you know, which is why I always end up writing for such a variety of shows, because I just, you learn something on every show that you do, whether it's a game show or, you know, I've done like weird magic shows and things, and they all have a different sort of thing that you can learn and go, oh, okay, this makes much more sense if I'm doing this shiny floor show. I definitely want to, you know, make sure that I don't try and fill this full of like topical jokes, and they don't want that. They want something funny off the back of someone's jacket,
yeah,
or something, you know, and you're like, you need to be able to do, that's a funny jacket.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we have 50 jokes on this guy's jacket? Like, I've just done that for a show where they literally just sent you pictures of what, I don't even know who the people are. They sent you pictures of the outfits that they were going to be wearing on the show and what they did for a living. And you just had to write jokes.
That's
about
so,
those.
That's fun. That's really creative.
Yeah, it was, at first you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's just a jacket. And then you're like, no, it's not just a jacket.
And looking back on your writing career so far, what are you proudest of?
I'm proudest of managing to get so much work, really, because when I started, I mean, I had no contacts and I had nothing. I literally had, you know, one day a week on a panel show that no one really knew about, and, you know, being able to work on so many different shows. It takes a long time Also, the BAFTAs, I love doing the BAFTAs. I used to watch those monologues and think, oh, that's a... You know, I just like jokes like that. And some people don't. And I've seen sort of people say on Twitter before, oh, I much, you know, they prefer it when it's just sort of straight TV presenter doing these things. Somebody put, yes, it's much nicer not to have these, like, laugh now jokes. And it's like... What does that mean?
Isn't that all jokes?
I quite like a laugh now joke. No, well, let's just have a laugh never joke then. Yeah. Just a sort of... Yeah.
A big thank you to Christine Rose, who you can find on Twitter at @xteen_rose. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Do share it or rate and review it if you did. And thank you very much to everyone who has done that already. To browse books by guests of this podcast, visit my shop at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, which is also in the show notes. I'll be back next week when my guest will be a much loved journalist. So see you then.